Well, thank you very much for the invitation. Very happy to be here. The topic is integrations of the information services. Joint work with Robert Farkas. And let me, just for beginning, let me state the result, and then I'll try to explain the notions. So the result is the following, that S in EN over C over complex numbers be a linearly normal K3 surface. Then the distribution of zeros in the Betti table depends on the geometry of hyperplane sections. Okay, so there are several things I have to explain. So first of all, what is this K3 surfaces and why linearly normal? What is linearly normal? Well, briefly, roughly speaking, linearly normal means that it doesn't come from a projection. We have an embedding on a higher dimensional projective space. Then, of course, well, the main thing which comes here is the Betti table. What is the Betti table? It's not the Betti numbers in the topological sense. It's in another algebraic sense. And this Betti table depends on the embedding. So it traces somehow. So there are some invariants of this particular embedding. And of course, I have to explain how does it depend on the geometry of hyperplane sections. So please let me allow to start with this part. Because that's a very general notion. So what's all about? We work with the following objects. So X projective variety. It can be over any field, but my favorite example is over complex numbers. And as such, so when I mention projective variety, it means that it admits an embedding into a projective space. So now there are two different ways of seeing this or introducing these varieties. There is one intrinsic way, like I see my variety here given by some invariance, something, some properties. And I know it's projective because I know it admits an embedding into a projective space. So this is the intrinsic way of introducing our objects. Or there is another way, which is a more direct and classical way. Like, I give my variety in the projective space given by zeros or a system of polynomial equations. So there is this abstract way, or the embedding definition. So in general, when we speak about the abstract definition, this is given by properties. Like fixing invariants, saying something about these objects that lie on the right. When we speak about the other way of introducing, we give equations. And as funny as might sound, we still don't have a complete picture of the relations between these two definitions. We understand pretty much what happens in general, but if I'm given one particular variety, either this side or the other side, to say how to go from one side to another is not, it's quite a tricky thing. So this is somehow the starting point of my problem. Understanding how to go from one side to another. And the starting point of this theory, so that's how we get to the so-called syzygy. And this syzygy theory will produce this beta tests. Okay, what is syzygy theory? Well, syzygy is a very funny word. So it appears in astronomics. It means when we have some celestial bodies that are aligned. In mathematics, it's pretty much the same. It would mean that some objects are aligned, but these objects are algebraic objects. So what is this syzygy theory? And I'm going to try to explain how this theory appears and why is it important. So this, let me just say that this theory is strictly related to the name of David Hilbert. It's a very famous paper published in 1899 in Mathematische Annalen. It's a foundational paper. David Hilbert was only 29 in 1899. And yet he was able to produce two results, among other things, that lay the foundation of this theory. So what's all about? Let me start with a very, very basic and very elementary discussion. So let's start with linear algebra. What does linear algebra say? So linear algebra deals with equations like that. M times x is 0, where m is a matrix. Say n times n over complex numbers. And what does linear algebra teach us? So, first of all, if we want to analyze this system of equations, we have the space of solutions. So, first of all, the solutions form a vector space. That's fine. Then, this vector space is generated by finitely many solutions. So we have finitely many solutions that generate the whole space. And we have, among all these systems that generate the space of solutions, we have a minimal or minimal systems of generators. That's how we get the basis, the notion of a basis. And well, linear algebra or the basis theorem says that all these minimal systems must have the same cardinality. So whatever we do, we cannot change the number of generators. Now let's try to do something different. So let's look again at this equation. And now let's move the elements of the matrix. So in the linear algebra case, this matrix is well, the elements of this matrix are constant, scalars, right? Now let's pretend that they move. They are not scalars, but they are functions. And since we are in this algebraic geometry setting, let's pretend that these functions are homogeneous polynomials in some variables. So now let's consider again. Again, the same equation, n times x equals 0, where this time the elements of m are homogeneous polynomials. In, I don't know, x1 up to xn. Well, if we do that, we expect that these solutions are, again, vectors of homogeneous polynomials. So x is a vector of homogeneous polynomials. Okay. And now let's ask the same questions. What is the structure of the space of solutions? So, the structure of the space of solutions. But the answer is the following. So, if we consider S to be the ring of polynomials, then this space, so-called space of solutions, is an S module. That's how the notion of a module arises. By solving linear equations with variable coefficients. Let's ask the second question. Is it true that we might find finitely many solutions that generate the space of solutions? Well, the answer is yes. And this is the basis, Hilbert basis theorem. Well, it's not taught like that in textbooks, but this is the meaning. Hilbert basis theorem says that we have finitely many solutions. That generate. Okay, so up to here the analogy is perfect. Let's ask this the last question. Let's inquire a bit about the minimum systems of generators. Do they have always the same cardinality? The answer is yes. Have the same cardinality. What's the difference then? Well, the difference is in this word here. Minimal systems in this variable settings, minimal systems of generators do not necessarily form a basis. In the following sense, so what does a basis mean in linear algebra? It means that we have vectors that generate the space, but they are linearly independent. So the question I'm asking here is it true that a minimal system of generators forms a so-called linearly independent system? Well, the answer is no. So this is minimal systems are not necessarily free. It means that we might have, for such a linear system, a minimal system of generators, and we might have some relations between these generators. So generators might have, this is the, that's how I'm making the point, that generators might be related by some non-trivial relations. So generators related by relations. And now it's time to employ the algebra. the mechanism, the techniques of algebra. So, okay, if we do have some relations, let's consider now the module of these relations. So consider the module of these relations. And now we can ask again the same questions. Is it true that we might find finitely many relations that generate all the relations? The answer is yes, again by the Hilbert-Hilbert theorem. Is it true that these relations are free? Well, we don't know. Might be or might be not. If they are, then we are happy. We stop here. If they are not, we have to continue. Consider relations. It might occur that there are relations between these relations. So we might have between relations. And so on. We can continue indefinitely. So we consider the new relations and ask whether they are free and so on. Well, no question. I know that we all infinite numbers and all, but still we are in the algebraic setting, so we like more finite numbers. So is this procedure a finite one? I mean, does this, if we play this game, does it stop or not? And now there's a second result of Hilbert, and it's called the Hilbert syzygy theorem. So, yes, after finitely many steps, we have to stop. So what we did here was to construct the so-called minimal resolution of this system of solutions for the linear equation. So, minimal resolution, it's something which is obtained by this process described here. So, we start with something which is an S module, let's call it, I don't know. Then we have finitely many generators, that means that we have a match, we have some error sum of something, and now, since we work with homogeneous polynomials, we have to arrange with the degrees to be the same. So what I'd like to do is, it might look funny, but it's consistent with the context. So let's take this ring of polynomials, take a homogeneous polynomial, and take the multiplication map. If this homogeneous polynomial is of degree d, if I multiply another polynomial, that would increase the degree by d, right? But that would mean that on the grading, on the usual grading, this morphism, this simple morphism, will shift the degrees. If I want to keep the degrees, say that an element of degree d goes to an element of degree d here, then I must declare that on the left-hand side, a homogeneous polynomial of degree d is actually of degree 0. So I have to shift the degrees. So that's the meaning here. So we have a sum. Then I take the kernel of this map, we get another sum. And so on. Well, Hilbert tells us that it should stop after finitely many steps, which is n plus 1 steps. Under one condition, that at each step I take a minimal number of generators. If not, if I had many more generators, we can actually go on to forever. Okay, so that's the notion of the minimal resolution. And the Betti table keeps track of the how to say that. So it keeps track how many times one particular element here appears how many copies of one element we have here each step. So it keeps track of the number of apparitions of each component at each step. It might look very complicated. It's not that complicated. It's just that it's a lot of information. That's why I prefer not to be very precise. Just give some indications of how does it look like. Okay. So this is a general theory.
What do you call S minus D? S is the ring of the polynomials?
S is the ring of polynomials.
And what is minus D? Is it degree minus D?
Yeah, degree minus D. So I declare that a linear polynomial in S of minus 1, constants have degree minus 1. And linear polynomials have degree 0. In S of minus 2, well, quadratic polynomials will be of degree 0 and so on. So there is a shift of degrees. And then all the morphisms we get here are of degree 0. We'll get degree 0 polynomials to degree 0 polynomials. Because we are in this, we have to do that. Because we are in the projective setting, if we did it in the affine case, then that game would not be necessary because the affine case doesn't care about degrees. It doesn't care about gradients. But in projective space, we have to do that because we work always with homogeneous.
Could you give a more precise definition of the Betti table
and yes.
The formula for the time?
Yeah, sure. Okay. So, actually, the table is the following. So I take my M, and then I give an example, just to illustrate. And now I have here S of minus J. That appears how many times? S of minus J. It appears, say, KJ 0 times, or BJ 0 times. This is over every j, but one final m j is not. Then, here we have s of minus j, and each s of minus j will appear to be j 1
okay.
And so on.
Okay.
So these are the Betti numbers, and they are in a Betti table, like that. So this is the column I, and here at the row J.
So the row is the depth, and the column is the degree.
Yes, exactly.
Degree.
Yeah. Here we will have the I plus J. Let me give some examples. So let's go back to my favorite.
I plus J.
Plus J, yes. Okay. I plus J.
Oh, okay.
Because there is a shift each time. That's why I like to there's a shift.
Okay.
So let's give an example. So let's consider something very simple. Let me discuss first the geometric setting and then give examples. So if S in Pn is a projective variety, it can be smooth or not. It can be reduced or not. Can be anything. Can be a scheme. And have multiple structures.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then we have the ideal, the homogeneous ideal of X, which is the ideal generated by all the homogeneous polynomials vanishing on X. So this is an ideal of S, which was C, X, Sn. And then we try to resolve the, our module will be the homogeneous coordinate ring, which is S over IS.
So it's just one step. So it can be any subscheme of Pn.
It can be any subscheme of Pn. Yeah. And we care about this S module, the obvious
structure.
And we ask about the Betti table, or which is the same, the minimal resolution of this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what is the meaning of that? Does it have the geometry of X, or it does have more with the embedding So let's give an example. It's a very simple example. Let's say take three distinct points.
Okay, so you take any homogeneous ideal in the polynomial ring.
Yes.
And you just take the corresponding module.
Exactly.
Okay.
Let's give an example. So this would be, my example would be x is q1, q2, q3. So 3 points. Mm-hmm. Well, seen in an abstract way, 3 points are just 3 points, whatever we do. But if we embed these 3 points in the plane, in the projective plane, then we might have some surprises. Because these 3 points in a plane can have different positions. Like, they can be in the general position. Let's try to identify what are the... So this is O2. So we have our 3 points. What are the equations of these 3 points? Well, in P2, if I'm given two quadrics will intersect in 4 points, possibly with multiplicities. So two quadrics will never cut out these 3 points. But if we take another quadric passing to 3 points, then we will get precisely what we want. So the ideal of X is generated by 3 quadrics. And these 3 quadrics, actually, I can write them down. So I have one quadric, which is the union of two lines. I intersect with another quadric, which is these other two lines. Well, if you just take the intersection, we are not in a very good shape, because we have a point and this line. So if we want to eliminate this line, we have to take a third quadric, which is union of these two lines. And these are, for example, some generators in the idea. Okay, and...
Why is it quadrics? Why not lines? Simple lines?
Because lines cannot... If we intersect lines, two lines will intersect in
only
orbit.
One.
And if we take another point...
So that's why you take the quadric and so on.
Exactly, yeah. If we take one more line, then we cannot...
You want a number of hypersurfaces whose intersection is exactly set theoretically this set of points.
And we can, if we write everything down in coordinates, we will see that these three quadrics have two linear relations. Let's try to do that. It's a good exercise. So if we choose p1, p2, p3 to be just the coordinate point, 1, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 1, then these three quadrics will be x, 0, x, 1. The other will be x, 0, x, 2. The third one will be x, 1, x, 2. Just a union of three lines. Let's call this q2, q1, q2, 0. What are the relations? So if we multiply q2 by x2 and this one by x1, we will get the same thing. So we get one relation, which is x2, q2, minus, this is q1, q1 is 0. Now, if we multiply this one by x1 and this one by x0, we get again the same thing. So x1, q1, minus x0, q0, this is 0. But the other relation, if we multiply this by x2 and this one by x0, we have to add these two relations. So actually, the third relation, which we might imagine, depends on the other two relations. So this means that we have two linear relations. Why do we need them? Because we have here linear coefficients. So my resolution would look like, so this is SX, this is S, so it's just the quotient map. Then we have three quadrics, which means that we have to shift by 2 because of degree 2 here, and take 3 copies. And we have two linear relations, which means that we have to shift once again by one and take two copies. And this is the linear, this is the normal resolution. And then the Betti table will be the following. So we have one from this S. Then we have three for stands for the this guys, and two here. And all the rest will be zero. So that's more or less what is it. And now let's take another example. So this is one example of 3 points embedded nicely in P2. Let's see what happens if all 3 points are on the line. This is another situation that can occur. So now let's take this. Well, in the ideal, we will have certainly this line. So in the ideal, we see already that there is no line in the ideal here because we have no line vanishing from all 3 points at the time. Whereas here we do have one. And we have the cubic, which is, well, you take any cubic. The cubic intersecting with the line of 3 points. Take any cubic passing through, for example, take again the cubic, which is formed by the union of the 3 lines. And then we have a line, L, and a cubic, we will call it D. And now we have, this will generate the ideal. But then we have one relation, which is P times L times L times P is 0. Although it's a trivial relation, but I have to take it into account. We could do the same here, multiply Q1, Q2 is Q1, Q2. But these depend on the other two. So here we have a better relation, whereas here it's different. Okay, and then the minimal resolution would be S of X, S. Then we have one copy of S of minus 1, plus one copy of S of minus 3. And then we have this relation, which would be an S of minus 4. Which means that if we analyze the Betti table here, it would be quite different. So we have one here, which stands for this one. Then we don't have any quadrics, but we have one cubic and one relation here. So there is certain formalism that needs to be used with, but essentially this is the picture. Then we can take 4 points, 5 points, and so on, so we can play with as many points as we want. And what we notice is that these Betti tables, actually, well, points are just points, but embedded in projective space, one way or another, this Betti table will keep track of the position. This is it. Okay. So this is about Betti tables. And when I speak about distribution of zeros, it means that I take my Kedger surface, I construct the Betti table, and I ask on what the distribution of zeros will depend. And the answer is, it depends on the geometry of hypercompensation. So that's what I intend to explain now. That's the second part of my talk. So the second part, K3 surfaces. So I know that K3 surfaces appear in theoretical physics. I don't know how, I'm afraid. But I know that there are strong relations because they are somehow the simplest Calabi-Yau manifolds or holomorphic symplectic or hyperkähler manifolds. So there are plenty of situations that occur in theoretical physics. But as I said, I do more projective geometry, so I'm interested in equations. So what is a K3 surface? So S is called K3 if S has trivial canonical bundle, and which one OS is here, which in particular would mean that the order characteristic is.
What do you mean by two-tier canonical bundle? You don't have any curve corresponding to that, you have one to point or something.
Well, it means that if you wish that you have a holomorphic two form,
yes,
that is nowhere vanishing.
Uh-huh.
This is the which is
nowhere vanishing global sections.
Exactly, nowhere vanishing global section. Which is well, holomorphic symplectic. Or well, the canonical is isomorphic to all as G's. So the this terminology was introduced by Solistiuto on the day. It appeared, it's very funny, in a report. Well, we all know about reports, but André Weil actually, when he wrote the report to a grant, he came up with this this notion of K3, and he said that he wanted to celebrate two things. So one is the mountain K3, so just to express the beauty of the notion, and the other one was for three famous mathematicians, K3's work with Keller, Kummer, and Kodaira. Well, there are plenty of other mathematicians whose names start with K, like Kronecker and so on. But this is also under debate. So there's this, you know, André Weil was French, but he spent almost all of his life in the United States. On the other hand, there is the German school, which claimed that it goes back. This notion was actually due to Felix Klein, another K, famous K. So whatever, what's the actual truth, I don't know. Thing is that we have this notion, it's very interesting from many points of view, and let's give some examples, right? So just to convince that we do have K3 surfaces. So first example is a quartic. So take any equation of the homogeneous equation of degree 4 that produces a smooth surface. This would necessarily be a K3 surface. Let's take now in P4. Let's take the intersection of a quadric and a cubic in P4. That's again a K3 surface. Or take the intersection of three quadrics in P5. It's again a K3 surface. So these are all examples given by equations, which was on this blackboard on the right hand side. Let's see another example given by something more intrinsic. So let's consider A to be an abelian surface. So if you wish, the torus of dimension 2. Being an abelian surface, we naturally have an evolution which is given by the reflection with respect to the symmetry with respect to 0. So any element x is sent to minus x. So we have an evolution. And now we take a quotient of this evolution. Of A, sorry, through this evolution. Well, this thing will have some singularities because we do have points of order 2, and they are fixed by this evolution, one of them being the 0. So we have precisely 16 points of order 2. But in algebraic geometry, we know whether whenever we have a bad object, which is singular, we can singularize. So we can singularize by blowing up these 16 points. And what we get here is a K3 surface, which is called the Kummer surface. Kummer surface associated to the origin of the
So you mean if A is an elliptic surface, then A over I has 16 blow-up points.
What elliptic? A billion.
It's
a four torus.
Could be an elliptic.
Elliptic is a billion. Elliptic is not.
No, yeah, no, not necessarily. It depends.
Then you have the group structure of the elliptic surface, right?
A billion is elliptic, but not the other way around. So he meets the involution.
Well, we do have elliptic Cajun surfaces, which are not a billion. Or you take the product of an elliptic curve and the curve of higher genus. It's not a billion, but it is elliptic.
If you resolve a general elliptic surface, you won't have a case.
Okay, so we do have examples. And now let's try to say something about the building tables of Cajuns. And I'm trying to explain why is this important. So maybe I do it now. I'm not going to prove it, I just stated. So vanishing of building numbers. Building numbers are just, or gradient building numbers, sorry. Not together with numbers. So, vanishing of great vector numbers is an offer. What does it mean? So, whenever you take a family of polarized varieties or embedded varieties, you take 1 degree, Bij, and you ask, some of them will have, for I and J fixed, will have the Bij 0, some will not have. But the meaning of this fact is that those that don't have 0 Bij form a Zariski closed subset. And actually it's more than that. We can, on the locus, so for the bad locus, we can give a skew structure. So somehow the non-vanishing will give subskews in parameter spaces. So for instance, if you take the moduli space of curves, or the tight neural space if you wish, and you choose some embeddings, some God-given embeddings like canonical embeddings or whatever, and then those curves, which don't have some particular vector number 0, will form a subscheme of the modulus space. And it's very, having naturally defined subschemes is very useful if you want to analyze the geometry of some spaces. So that's somehow using this kind of techniques. Gabi Farkash was able to disprove a very famous conjecture, which is called the Stoke conjecture on NG. So the first, he did it with Mihnah Popov on M10, and then they extended for any G of type, I don't remember, 6i plus 4, something like that. So there are plenty of examples. Slope conjecture, this is false. Because they were able to construct using these techniques some subschemes that contradicted what was predicted by the slope conjecture. So from our point of view, it's very important to be able to control these things, because in doing so we will have information about the subschemes. So in particular, K3 surfaces form a moduli space of dimension, but we have to fix this n, and this is 19 plus n, something like that. And if we know about the beta table of any K3 surface, then we can get nice subschemes in this moduli space, which is by no means compact. So this is a non-compact space, because we might have starting at work. Like here, we have quartics, but the smooth quartics, UP3,
not from something which is compact, because we also have the non-smooth particles, which are the generated surface. So we have something.
So you, when you consider this module space, you consider only the smooth KFT surfaces?
Yeah, smooth.
You don't go to the...
Yeah, sorry, I didn't... Yeah. I should have mentioned this.
Yeah, okay.
Smooth. By definition.
Thanks.
Okay. Actually, it's a very hard problem. So there are compactifications of these module spaces by using Hodge theory. Mm-hmm. But the thing is that we don't know geometrically what's the limiting points. So this is a big issue, and one of the main experts is Radu Laza, working in this area, like finding geometric compactifications of the module spaces.
Do you like his name, Radu?
Laza.
Laza.
Okay. So he works on this problem, finding geometric compactifications of K3 surfaces.
It's very relevant to F theory, you know this issue, that the physics requires
So you can Google the he has some results on compactifications of this module spaces.
Okay.
Because we are also interested in knowing what are the objects that we put in order. It's just not some structures somewhere. We would like to say, well, it's this kind of surface which is whatever. Yeah. Okay. So now because I mentioned hypertransections here and the geometry of hypertransections, now it's time to say in which sense the geometry of hypertransection is relevant for the derivatives of surfaces. And now I switch from surfaces to pairs, so I take the single curve and associated to so any curve will have some invariants. So the first and most important is the genus. And fixing the genus, we have a moduli space, Henschi. Or Dipiro space. If you are more on the differential geometry side, you might actually want to fix the topological type and consider the variations of complex structures on that, but here, since we are in the algebraic geometry settings, G will be C, which is 0 time. And now there are other invariants telling how special these curves are in a module space. So imagine that this module space is it's like a big cheese of dimension 3, G minus 3. And you want to say if you pick something from inside, whether that thing is special or not, if it has a different taste from yours or it has the general taste. And then we do have some invariants. One invariant, which is relevant for our problem, is the Clifford index. And the Clifford index is defined as follows. So if I take L, B, line bundle, one. And I take the linear system. So please stop me if you need some more explanation about it. I can take these residuals. So here we have a bunch of points in this linear system. Here we have another bunch of points. We can add that up and get some points in the linear system of the canonical bundle.
What is the time space here? So?
It's just the product.
The product of line bundles of
Cartesian product of
Cartesian
linear
product.
Systems.
So this is
Cartesian
project space.
Yeah.
So we have pairs of divisors. On the one hand, the divisors here, and on the other hand, here.
Yeah.
We add them up. And what happens is that if we fix a divisor in the canonical system, there are only finitely many ways, possible ways of distributing this points in one side and another. Mm. So what I'm saying is that this map is finite on the image.
Mm.
Right? Finite on the image. So actually the co-dimension of the image is the difference of these dimensions. And I call this the Clifford index of
cellules is the codimension of the image, which can be computed.
It's related to index theorem, right?
Exactly, yes. So this is, I hope I'm not wrong, so it's the degree of L minus twice the number of sections,
yes,
plus
L1. So the so-called, why is it called Clifford index? Because this is positive, this is Clifford's theorem, but when I stated that this is finite on the image, this is the proof of Clifford. So if you look it up in Herschel's book, for example, this is the proof that Clifford is positive. Okay, now what are the relevant bundles? Well, if either this one or this one is a point, or even worse, the empty set, then that's not interesting. So we are interested in situations where these are real varieties, more than points. So we are interested in those L's that have two conditions. So the interesting case is when the dimension L is bigger than 1, the dimension K minus L is also bigger than 1. So in this case, we say that L contributes to the Clifford index of C. Okay. And now, these Clifford indices will have different values. The Clifford index of the curve is the minimum value of all the Clifford indices where L is relevant in this sense. L contributes. And why is it important in our situation? It is because of the results due to Greene and Laza. So the statement is much more general, but I'm just going to stick to the situation. So if C, little c, is P of C, then B I J of C is zero for any draw the better table. It's easier this way. So the theorem says the following. So we consider C embedded in PG minus 1 by the non-linear system. And let's consider the Betti table of this curve. When I mentioned it's embedded, I already throw out the bad case, which is of hyperelliptic curves. And the Betti table would look like the following. So we have a 1, which corresponds to, you know, the first map. Then we will have some quadrics, linear relations between quadrics and so on. Okay, and the Green-Lazarsov theorem says that here, this column, which is G minus C minus 2, so C is the Clifford index of C, this element here is different from 0. So it's just that. A statement about the non-vanishing of some element in the Betti table of canonical. Why is this canonical situation interesting? Because the Betti table is symmetric. We can actually prove that it's symmetric. So if we look at the Betti table, it will be symmetric. It will have a 1 here, G minus 2, and it will be symmetric with respect to its center. So actually, if we know what happens when on this row here, we also know what happens on the other row because of this symmetry. Okay, and there was a conjecture which is called Green's conjecture, which stated that from here on, all the others are zero. So Green's conjecture is the following. So I am drawing again this table.
So I get here g minus c minus 2 column. Here we have g minus c minus 1 columns. And this conjecture is that that was 0, that was 0, and so on. So this is Green's conjecture. Okay, then what were the cycles which we can construct on the modular space of curves will have something to do with the Clifford index. Right. And from the point of view of minimal resolutions, the Clifford situation is interesting because the remark is that if S in Pn is a linearly normal K3, and C in S is a hypercurrent section, then, well, hypercurrent section means that I take a hyperplane and cut S, so I get actually the C is S intersected to P n minus 1. So C will be in Pn minus 1. Then the many tables of C, well, this embedding here is actually the canonical embedding, nothing else. And the Betty tables of S and C coincide. So that was something that was remarked by Mark Green. The Betty tables of S in Pn and of C in Pn minus 1 coincide. So knowing the zeros in the Betty table of S and knowing the zeros in the Betty table of C is the same thing. So if Green conjecture was true for C, then we would have a complete picture of the distribution of the Betty table of this S. In particular, well, we know that it's symmetric because the Betty table of C is symmetric. And what I did with Gabi was to prove that Green's conjecture is true for any hyperplane section of a K3 surface. Okay. And then, well, now comes the even more technical part, which is the proof. So I'm not going to go into details because it uses a lot the fact that we work on a K3 surface, which provides us with a lot of geometric objects, which are vector bundles on K3 surfaces, which we understand quite well. So we have to use them. So basically, the proof of this theorem is vector bundle techniques plus a big result, which was proved by Claire Poisson before, which was that Green's conjecture is true for genome curves of any genus. So, yeah, I think I'll stop here.
If I can ask you one more favor, so if you can give the formal definition of linearly normal,
yes,
so that everybody can understand the condition.
Yeah, sure. So the linearly normal means that, so linearly normal, it is an important assumption here. We don't know what happens if it's not linearly normal. So linearly normal for X in the projective space means that if we take the sections, the hyperplane sections of X and the hyperplane sections of the projective space itself, that this is surjective. Meaning that any hyperplane section comes from the geometric interpretation is the following. So we cannot embed X in a high-dimensional projective space such that this embedding is given by projection from upstairs, from a point not lying on X. So for example, if you want to get non-linearly normal things, just take any variety in a projective space, take a point outside and project to Pn minus 1. You get something which is not linear. Like take a cubic curve
into three. What's called a twisted cubic. So this is cubic. So if you project from a point on x, you will get the conic. If you project from outside, you will get a cubic in P2, which is not linear anymore. So what we require is that a sort of maximality of this.